Welcome to Worlds Apart. For decades, if not centuries, Russian strategists have mused about the development of northern and eastern frontier as one of the key drivers for Russia's economic development and security, which, however, requires access to the world's best technology. With the West cutting almost all ties with Russia over Ukraine, will those dreams once again have to be put on ice? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Alexei Chukunkov, Russia's Minister for the Development of the Far East and the Arctic. Minister, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Good afternoon.
Now, it's interesting that in the Russian language, unlike, for example, in English, we can use the word north in plural as north rather than, let's say, singular. And it's indeed an enormous territory in terms of mileage, in terms of cultural, geological, ethnic, industrial, economic, political diversity. But I wonder how you can manage or even develop that territory from your office in Moscow, which is, you know, many, many thousands of kilometers away.
I give you two facts about Russia north and the Far East. Russia is north. We are two-thirds permafrost. And Russia is Asia. We are three-quarters in Asia. So we cover 18 regions of Russian Federation, the closest one being Murmansk, which speaks a lot about our mandate. The farthest one is Chukotka, which is 9 time zones away. So I spent quite a bit of time in airplanes.
Now, there is a stereotype that governance in Russia is extremely centralized. But if one looks deeply into the administrative history of Russia, it tends to be that remote regions suffer from the shortage of governance rather than excess of it due to, you know, remoteness, the lack of logistics, infrastructure, sometimes the resentment of the local population. You've been minister for less than 2 years. What would you say are some of the biggest challenges that you had to face?
Well, I had quite a long preparatory period as chief executive of Far East Development Fund, so I could count almost 9 years of very close, deep involvement in Far Eastern and Northern aspects. And the key fact I would like to cite is we have a total new breed of governors, very important. Those people who were governors in 2013, when I was first called by Mr. Trutnev to join him as CEO of the fund, was completely different breed of people whom than what we have now. So I think, as we call, we say the fish rots from the head, but here I think the development is really very important when the heads of the government are young, technocratic, passionate, transparent, patriotic people who build respective teams who in turn really spread this. This is values. This is about values and attitude.
But you know, it's a common problem in the Russian regions when you have these very progressive technocratic people and they come to those remote regions and they do not always establish good connection with the locals. Is that a problem?
Well, I would insist that leadership is very important. It's not only government leadership, it's also leadership in terms of entrepreneurs. Who are the leaders of actual projects? You know, one of the hardest regions is Zabaykalia, is where Chita is. Every third citizen has an active criminal record. So of 1 million people, you have 350,000 who either been to jail or was sentenced. But they have one of the most active entrepreneurs, the guy from Chita, who came back from London after 8 years in private equity, who is very actively investing in real estate, agriculture, beer production, and so forth and so forth. So when I see cases like this, I do really believe that first you have little islands or islets, you have an archipelago, and then you have an actual continent of efficiency, of progress.
You mentioned the word archipelago, and one of the associations with the Russian East and the Russian North is Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag archipelago. The fact that you just mentioned about Zabaykalia, one-third having active criminal record, does it have anything to do with that legacy?
Yes, the Far East, originally, it was the territory to produce resources for 400 years. First furs, then gold, silver, oil and gas. Then it was frontier, military frontier to defend, and then it was a big prison. Mm-hmm. Now it's the most dynamic territory for economy, and we call the turn to the east, the pivot to the east. I would say our pivot to the east happens, sorry, I will confuse you, via north. Mm-hmm. Because to transport stuff to the east, we really need to develop the northern sea route. Mm-hmm. So this is the one common topic that connects the Far East and the Russian Arctic mm-hmm. and the whole Russia, is the ability to produce stuff in Murmansk region, or in Yamal, or in Norilsk, and transport it to Asia, bypassing land routes.
Now, you mentioned the sort of the change in attitude towards those regions from exploitative to, well, even the big prison camp at a certain point. Will they ever become places where people actually like to live, rather than being sent for because of some material stimulus or because of some, you know, political necessity? Do you believe that the development can trump harsh climates in order to turn those territories into real homes?
Well, it is. You know, climate, when people cite climate as the reason why they don't like to live somewhere, they're not being honest. Mm-hmm. London doesn't have a perfect climate. Neither do
Petersburg, where we are
exactly
actually recording this
but
interview.
But people like these places. So I would say these are very powerful places, really a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. In every single, the most remotest, Anadyr in Chukotka, still is a very powerful place. So the key thing is reason to be, mm-hmm. why people come there. And I think this is what is important, is we really reignite this feeling of something historical happening, mm-hmm. huge projects being done.
Inspiration,
exactly. This is about emotions, mm-hmm. the reason why people live their lives the way they do. Mm-hmm. So I think the Far East is offering a perfect reason for people, building this new reality of Russia in Asia, Russia and Asia, and being able to visit. Of course, the last 2 years were quite a bit mm-hmm. challenging, but before the pandemic, especially in southern regions of the Far East, where half our Far Eastern population mm-hmm. live, it was normal for people every month to go out to Korea, to Japan, to China. It's like between Moscow and St. Petersburg. So this really gives you a feeling of belonging to Asia, which is good.
I heard you say before that the Russians, more than any other people, know, love and enjoy the North. And as much as I want to agree with you, not so recent Soviet history offers many examples of a pretty heartless and quite exploitative attitude towards that land. Do you think the Russians have had opportunity to atone for what they done, for what their predecessors done to this part of the world?
Well, this work has just begun. And I would say a lot remains to be done. We are really trying to clean up the Arctic, and we are responsible for half the total Arctic Russian Federation, and this is a common goal. The Northern Sea Route is being developed in a very ecologically responsible way. Number one, nuclear power, which is used for icebreakers and which is also used to supply key investment projects, is the cleanest power of all. Then we plan the next generation of vessels to run on LNG. And in general, our north produces the biggest amounts of gas. Yamal is a huge source of gas, which is much cleaner fuel than coal. So I would say in this respect, Arctic does contribute to global ecological balance. Mm-hmm. But of course, certain practices from Soviet times when people really didn't pay attention to cleaning up, we have the sentence in Russia called northern supply, mm-hmm. which is in Russian to bring something, mm-hmm. but we never had the take out that.
So took whatever out the was trash.
Exactly whatever was brought there, big barrels of stuff, like lots of metals, of remnants, of rotten stuff, is still there. Mm-hmm. But I'm very optimistic about people, especially youth, now being conscious about it, and we have volunteers who go for months, clean up every region, and I personally hold pretty much every month a gathering of all northern governors, and every governor produces hundreds of people. So overall, thousands of people, volunteers, mm-hmm. who do that job.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Russian hydrocarbons, and the Russian Arctic holds about 25% of Russian oil reserves, more than 70% of natural gas reserves, but the demand for those, at least from the European side, has significantly decreased. Do you have, if not altogether evaporated, do we have other industries, other anchors to stimulate the development plans that you are tasked with implementing?
Well, it's very important to finish the job that is to be finished. And our natural resources is not a resource curse. It's a God-given treasure, literally. The investment projects that we now see in Arctic, and we develop Northern Sea Route to enable them to take out those merchandise, will produce $100 billion revenue every year in 5 to 7 years from now. $100 billion USD.
Even taking into account the recent geopolitical changes and
the world difficulties? The world is not confined to the United States and even European states. Two-thirds of the world, they do business with Russia, they present demand for those resources, and it's pretty much infinite. You only need to check the prices for those oil, gas, coal, metals, gold, copper, nickel, palladium, and all the other stuff that our Arctic produces to see, because the price is a only objective measurement of demand-supply balance. So it's not about only demand evaporating. Mm-hmm. It's about where you have demand, where you have supply. Mm-hmm. All the Asian countries are being supplied from the Russian Arctic by key vital energy resources.
Now, technological expertise and competitiveness have been perennial issues for this country. We have many bright ideas. Mm-hmm. We often have difficulties implementing them in practice.
Right.
I'm sure you would agree that our access to Western technology has been severely curtailed. Can Russia pull it off on its own? Does it need support from the outside?
It's not only about whether we can or not. We should, so we will. When Russia is cornered, you know it performs the best. And in terms of technological self-sufficiency, I'm an economist by training, and I was frankly very worried that we built an extreme version of consumer capitalism, where we literally converted all the proceedings of our natural resources into buying stuff, and mostly buying stuff from the West. Mm-hmm. But of course, historically, Russian society was able to produce fantastic things. You know, we launched Sputnik in 57, 10 years after the end of the most destructive war that has ever happened to Russia.
Well, at a huge human cost as well. I mean, and
it was.
The price to people's living
standards. So instead of what I see and what I believe in, instead of consumer capitalism, where we were not able to produce a lot of stuff, we will build a creative, socially oriented, and sovereign form of organization. I would not want to even to call it capitalism, because Russia will never be governed by large pools of capitals. Russia is a very statist place, because we're the largest country in the world. So yes, I'm optimistic. We will produce whatever we need.
But Minister, not that I want to argue with you, but I know that prior to the Russian operation in Ukraine, you were one of the advocates of wider cooperation with foreign enterprises, for example, for the development of the Russian icebreaking fleet.
Right.
You spoke in favor of that. Do you think those plans will still be able to be realized without some of that expertise?
It's competitive. Number one, I do not believe that the current freezing of relations will last too long, because it's rational for all humanity to cooperate on key topics, like Arctic. You cannot have two separate camps of countries taking care of Arctic. Russia responsible for half the Arctic, and seven other countries, members of the Arctic Council, who now simply canceled all cooperation. But Arctic is unique, and it's in its entirety. Mm-hmm. So I believe some countries will come to it faster, some countries will take longer, but I believe there will be a restoration of certain cooperation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Russia threw itself into globalization so eagerly and so unpreparedly. Look at China. Currency still not freely convertible. Markets still very much protected. And it took them 40 years to protect and to carefully nurture local competencies. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you need to create conditions that now are being created naturally and even forcefully, that will enable us to a little bit build that inner strength that we need as a self-sustainable economy.
Okay, well, Minister, we have to take a very short break right now. We will be back in just a few seconds. Stay tuned.
Putin is the aggressor. Today, I'm authorizing additional strong sanctions. Today, Russia is the country with the most sanctions imposed against it, a number that's constantly growing.
Стратегия сейчас направлена на сокрушение российской экономики, на нанесение максимального ущерба.
We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy.
Sucks, like, we're suffering the price for something that's happening in another country.
Вопрос узловой, который сейчас решается, это судьба доллара как мировой резервной валюты.
Joe Biden, in imposing these sanctions on Russia, you know, has destroyed the American economy. So there's your boomerang effect.
Counter the Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays, on est en France quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
А у нас ни воды, ни хлеба, вообще ничего.
Здесь продуктовые наборы, здесь есть все.
Обстреливают еще нацики, понимаешь?
Азовцы, если находили московские телефоны или что, убивали в хлам.
Нацики отходили, просто заливали бензином с канистр, подпаливали и уходили.
Люди очень боятся, чтобы сюда назад не вернулась Украина.
Детей можете отдельно собрать, сейчас закончим сладкая розанка.
Главный принцип – все, что собирают люди в России, донести непосредственно в руки нуждающимся здесь, на территории Донбасса.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Alexei Chikunkov, Russia's Minister for the Development of the Far East and the Arctic. Minister, you mentioned the issue of the Russian North Sea route a couple of times, and Russian strategists usually talk about it as, you know, something that can turn Russia into this logistical superpower. But I wonder if the recent experience of the air travel industry with many Western companies, and not only Western companies, limiting their flights to and over Russia, offer a bit of a cautionary tale in this regard. Even if we develop it, do we have enough demand?
Well, I know in big detail every single project that needs Northern Sea Route to export its produce. 40% of that is liquefied natural gas. All the investments was already made, and in 5 to 7 years from now, we need to export 50 million tons per year. The other one is oil by Rosneft. Investment already made, 5 to 7 years, another 50 million tons. I will not even go further because
so it's the Russian-driven demand.
It's the Russian-driven demand, exactly. Okay. The demand for the merchandise is in Asia, but the goods have to be transported from the Arctic, from Yamal, from Norilsk, from Chukotka to Asian markets. Mm-hmm. The only way to do that is by completing the development of Northern Sea Route, mm-hmm. by completing the ice-breaking fleet, the ice-class transport fleet, ports, satellites, communication infrastructure, security and emergency infrastructure. Mm-hmm. This will be done.
Now, the development of the Arctic is very intimately linked to the issue of the climate change. And I heard you say that for you, there is no debate whether or not it's happening, simply right. based on the number of natural calamities and emergency right. situations you have to pay attention to. Is there something that Russia or any other country can really do to fully prepare itself for that, given the unpredictability of what is actually happening and the scale?
You know, the the most efficient solutions are usually the simplest and the most obvious. Use more nuclear power, burn less coal. Isn't it simple? So why is France, a very developed and intelligent country, using almost 80% of nuclear power? And why is Germany giving up on nuclear power?
Why?
So that's politics. That's people, you know, psychology. People perceive risks differently.
So you call the French more intelligent than Germans?
Not necessarily, no, because then we would have to throw the English and the Italians to make it all an anecdote. But what I'm saying is we have proven solutions that already exist hundreds of times, and nuclear power is one such solution that the humanity needs to use much more broadly. Mm-hmm. And for instance, what we do is we use floating nuclear stations, with the first example in Chukotka, and now even building to supply new investment projects. We're building four of those. This could be used anywhere in the world. Wherever people live on the seashore, you can dock a floating nuclear station, then you have 50, 60 megawatts per block.
But Minister, you're talking about not exacerbating, using technology not to exacerbate the problem, but
yes.
The problem already exists, and you know, nature generally doesn't recognize borders. Neither do floods, fires, smoke. We share a very large border with China, which, you know, whatever geopolitical, tender geopolitical feelings we may have towards one another, is the biggest polluter in the world.
Right.
Are there any ways to ensure that the actions of somebody else in that realm do not affect us? That's what I'm asking about.
Well, you know, before the unprecedented debacle with Western sanctions and the Western economic attack on Russia, I was of the opinion that climate agenda was to be the unifying mechanism to force certain countries to do what all the other countries want. Because otherwise, how can you force India? You're talking about China, but think about India. 1.5 billion people who are eager to catch up on industrial developments and who need to burn billions of tons of coal for that. And India is a vibrant democracy. They will do whatever the people want. It's a genuine democracy. The Indian leaders will do whatever people want, and people want cheap power. Frankly, Indian farmers do not care about CO2 emissions, with all respect. So how can you force them to do anything? It's impossible. That's why it requires multilateral mechanisms and a healthy international system of international relations that what we really do not observe right now.
I even heard you compare the issue of climate change to the efforts of trying not to have another third world war in the second half of the 20th century.
Exactly.
Now, if we look around, the possibility of a global conflict has dramatically increased. Does it mean that we are doomed in the realm of climate change? Because clearly this global agenda takes not just the second, but the, you know, 10th seat to whatever geopolitical necessity there is.
Well, I try to follow the wise men, and I see the business leaders, and none of them stopped ESG agenda for 1 minute, in spite of the last couple of months. We're really busy for largest Russian businesses to readjust, to find new ways of supplies, financial mechanisms, new markets, new logistical systems. Still, all of them keep on their strategy a certain level of greenery, of ecological balance, because it will come. It will come as a global tax or in some other ways. Those businesses who will ignore this topic, they will be hit by a certain tax, whatever it's called, a carbon tax, and suddenly hit. So I think that businesses must take the lead, and that's what's happening.
Given that you have experience in both the corporate world and the governing world, and I assume some knowledge of how those things are operating in the West, who do you think have the most influence on that climate change issue? Is it the business leaders or ultimately the government or political leaders?
Well, it's all connected, you know, because business leaders, they are interested in political stability. Mm-hmm. Political leaders, they are sort of more attuned to popular sentiment. But popular sentiment is being formed by businesses, because mm-hmm. businesses produce information. That's your business. Mm-hmm. So we see a lot
propaganda of propaganda sometimes.
Well, propaganda, information, whatever you call it. We see a much stronger ecological political movement which creates awareness and people start thinking about it.
Is the concern for the environment among the masses, among the public, still there, given all the propaganda they've been fed about the Ukrainian war?
Remember, 6 months ago, everyone was talking about the pandemic. Now, much less. So I think climate change will reemerge as an important topic at some point, because people see floods, people see fires, people see heat waves, and it makes the news. So now, the past couple of months, the Ukraine crisis made the news, but even already I think there is a certain tiring of that, but climate change will remain, and our Arctic is a very important arena where climate change will manifest and will be discussed.
Now, you mentioned the issue of the pandemic, and one of the potentially very dangerous issues you raised before was that of biological security.
Right.
As the permafrost melts, it may release ancient viruses.
Right.
How big is a threat of another major pandemic that our northern territories may produce?
Well, I will not answer you about the pandemic. I'm not a biological expert, but
is that a real risk as far as you are concerned?
The risk is releasing all the methane that is contained in permafrost, and that's a very, very actual risk, because Arctic heats up faster than the rest of the world. It heats up because all the accumulated climate pollution in the previous hundreds of years. And now we have 2.5% faster heating up of Arctic. As I told you, and it's well known, Russia is 65% permafrost. A lot of our cities and a lot of our businesses are built on permafrost. Mm-hmm. So not only that infrastructure is at risk, but all the methane captured in that permafrost, if it goes into the atmosphere, the whole planet will suffer badly. So that's why we are interested in containing global warming and containing climate change, subject to using reasonable solutions. As I said, we shall not create some fantastic or financial speculative mechanism where, you know, trillions of dollars exchange hands in some obscure financial instrument, carbon credits, but where is their actual real, you know, clean electricity, and it has to be clean. You know, the German, and it's called Energiewende, the German shift to clean energy resulted in German burning more coal because they needed more reserve capacity to ensure against fluctuations in energy demand. That shall not be the case. So it really has to be managed much more responsibly.
Now, Minister, I've covered the work of the Arctic Council for a couple of years, and this used to be the platform where some of those issues were debated and even some decisions were made. I remember that even the Canadians and the Americans used to tell that the Russians are actually good in the north. So it was an area of genuine cooperation, and I think a place where we try to treat each other fairly, but as you mentioned, the Arctic Council gathered last March and it pretty much excluded Russia. Do you think there's any venue left for, you know, those ties to be built meaningfully with an impact?
It has to be, because the Arctic is humanity's concern, to all humanity. We receive questions and the important inquiries about Arctic from China, India, the Middle East, Southeast Asia. Everyone is concerned about what happens to Arctic, how Northern Sea Route is going to evolve, what is global warming, how to obtain energy resources of the Arctic. So we cannot have a small group of countries, you know, seven countries to exclude 170 countries from that topic. So I believe we will return to reasonable dialogue in some time.
Am I hearing you correctly that by excluding Russia, the Arctic Council pretty much canceled itself as a
Absolutely.
Viable organization?
It cut the Arctic in two, but you cannot, you know, you cannot cut a cup in two and hope it to contain what it's got. Mm-hmm. So now you have an empty half of nothingness. Mm-hmm. And we have to resume normal consultations, normal dialogue, as soon as possible.
And finally, Russia has the largest coastline in the Arctic, and it's also an area vital for the country's security. It hosts a number of strategic military installations, and Western analysts have long been accusing Russia of trying to militarize the North. I wonder how much cooperation or even synergy there is between your ministry and the Ministry of Defense.
We support our servicemen in all respects. And I have to tell you that our Arctic Shield is very strong and the people who serve there are very brave. It's my honor to spend some time with them, and it, frankly, it gives me a lot of inspiration. So,
but does it give you also the, you know, a certain inspiration for development, I guess? Can it be used simultaneously, both the building of those installations and developing the
Everybody
region?
Does their own work. So military protects, businessmen create businesses, the government ensures social infrastructure, ensures education, healthcare, and all the other things. And as I told you, that young new breed of governors who create around them a really very positive environment, very positive vibe. Look at Murmansk region, look at Arkhangelsk, look at every single one of them, Yamal, Yakutia, Chukotka. You see people who really love what they do and love the region where they live, and they don't want to move to Moscow. So I see those islets, that archipelago of new reality being created in Arctic, and we do our best to support that.
Well, Minister, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for this very inspiring conversation.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.